As the innovative webmaster behind Howard Dean's pioneering presidential campaign in 2004, who also closely advised Barack Obama's senatorial campaign that same year, Nick O'Mealy is renowned as a technological visionary who understands perhaps better than anyone else how radical connectivity and the digital realm can instantly propagate new ideas and completely render obsolete the traditional power structures between corporations, governments, and individuals. Now, in a new book, The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath, he offers a breakdown of how new technology is changing our world. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Nick O'Mealy to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Hi, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Joe.
Well, it's a delight to have you here. How did you come to this idea of the new Goliath, if you will?
Well, you know, just looking around at the last 10 years, you know, I was trying to think about ways that that challengers use the internet to go after the establishment. Howard Dean used the internet to raise money to challenge the establishment. Barack Obama used the internet to challenge the establishment in the form of Hillary Clinton's candidacy. And now, the last few years, we've seen the Tea Party challenging the establishment of the Republican Party. And not only that, but if you look at the private sector at companies, if you look at education, if you look at the entertainment industry, pretty much across the board, it begins to become clear that outsiders are challenging the establishment or the institutions in these different industries with generally a great deal of success. And I wanted to understand what the dynamics of that were and really look at if that was a good or a bad thing. And it turns out it's a little bit of both.
So it being a little bit of both, and you certainly get that idea in the book, but where do we have to approach it from? Because it is, the internet is so huge that I don't, is it safe to say that not many of us understand its enormity?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the challenge we're in right now, is that these days, 130 million Americans have smartphones. Smartphones are enormously powerful computers that 35 years ago, Cray supercomputer cost $5 million and would have filled the room. And now 130 million Americans walk around with that kind of power in their pockets. And that's a pretty significant change. My argument is that that's a pushing of power out of institutions to individuals. It's a redistribution of power in a really fundamental way that we've yet to get our heads around. We don't entirely understand what's happening or the implications of what's happening to all of our institutions.
You do talk in the book about the necessity to exercise better and stronger control over these new technologies. How do we do that?
Well, I think it begins with some education on our own parts. There's a strange kind of reluctance to engage super deeply on technology on the part of many people. I watch people all the time abdicate kind of normal reason and sensibility to technologists. One of the things that drives me crazy is that if you go to get your phone fixed at the Apple store, it's called the Genius Bar. You know, we need to really take some ownership of our own technology and not be intimidated by it and start to think about its implications and how we can better use it to do things that we believe are important.
And part of the problem is that we consider anyone who can figure that out to be a genius, right? I mean, that's part of the problem.
Yeah, I call it nerd disease. We have this strange relationship with people who are experts in technology that we tend to abdicate a lot of our other, reasonable thinking, common sense thinking. And the fact is that nerds have, it's a culture and a viewpoint with its own strengths and weaknesses. And what we really need to do is try and get beyond that, not to be intimidated by the technology, but to decide what kind of world we want to live in and use the technology to build that world rather than let the technology drive these decisions.
You talk about in the book that there are these misconceptions about technology and this technological revolution. And one of the biggest is that these old institutions and their destruction is a good thing, is really a wrong-headed approach to reasoning.
Well, I think it's complicated. I mean, part of the reason that people are pursuing alternative ways of doing things is that they're pretty unsatisfied with the way things have been done. And in many respects, our institutions have not served us well. And so in that view, it's kind of natural to the people look outside of it. I mean, if you look at higher education, cost of a four-year diploma has skyrocketed over the last 20 years, and its economic value has plummeted. There was a Department of Labor statistic last year that 19% of parking attendants had four-year college degrees and an enormous amount of student loan debt. And so there's obviously something kind of amiss in how we've organized higher education and what we want out of it. And so people are seeking alternatives. They're opting out of it in various ways, from, you know, internet startups like Udacity and Coursera to this rise of what they call the massive online learning systems, or even something like Khan's Academy. But the truth is that our university and higher education system carries a lot of critical responsibilities in this day and age. Among them, you know, credentialing as well as basic research and peer-reviewed scientific journal. There's a whole system through higher education where we figure out what really works, right, through science and testing, and it's verified by other people in the field. And so before we give up on higher education because it's not working, we need to think a little more deeply about what it is that we want out of our higher education system, all the different pieces of it, from learning to preparing people for careers to teaching to credentialing to research and peer-reviewed work. And really begin to figure out, is this in the digital age, is this the best way to do it? And if not, what are some other ways of doing it?
Just looking at the title of the book, of the end of big, will we always have the technological onslaught that we have now? Or do we have to end that? Or do we just have to realize how to deal with it better?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that the march of technology is not about to slow down. I think it's a real challenge of leadership in the digital age is understanding how to navigate the enormous breadth and volume, intensity, stream, the constant contact of our new era. And I think we're still at the beginning of understanding what that does to not just institutions like I write about, but even relationships and to ourselves and to who we are as individuals and as people. And so, I mean, I don't have a satisfying answer there, except to say that we're really at the beginning of this. This is the beginning of a new time, and some of this stuff will get sorted out. It took a long time for newspapers and journalism to develop. To develop norms of operation, and it's going to take a long time for us to figure out some new appropriate ways of doing business in the digital age.
And I guess that's part of the issue, because we've always had to deal with new technologies. So what makes this different? I mean, we have somewhat of a track record, don't we?
Sure. I mean, if you go back and look at the history of everything from the telephone, radio, television, industrialization broadly, and we have a whole bunch of the last 200 years in terms of the scope of human history has thrown a huge volume of new technology into our lives, into our societies, into our institutions, and really effectively changed a lot of stuff. And so we've come to terms with it in the past, and we'll come to terms with it again, I have no doubt.
When you look at those who are providing the technology, do you get a sense of how much they're driving the bus and how much we are, in the sense of what we need or what we think we need and the industry telling us what we need and what we want and what is possible?
I mean, I think we need to drive the bus a lot more. There are leaders in technology in this day and age. You know, I like to say the even bigger six companies that control our online life for the most part: Amazon, Apple, eBay, Facebook, Google, and Microsoft/Skype. And those companies have an enormous amount of power, but there are also companies responding to market pressures and stock prices and profitability. And I think that part of this is that these companies need to think in a more sophisticated way about their role in society and their responsibilities to their customers. But I also think that part of it is up to us to demand of these companies a greater degree of accountability and flexibility, and to set out some clear visions of where we want to take things.
When you were, and I was reading your biography in the introduction, and talking about your work with Howard Dean's campaign, and obviously with President Obama's Senate campaign, how much did you know about the power going in, and how much did you learn in the process?
Oh, I would say they were overwhelmingly learning experiences.
Yeah.
You know, certainly on the Dean campaign, I just felt very much caught up in a really exciting moment in American history, where a lot of people were unhappy with a lot of Democrats were unhappy with the direction of the Democratic Party and wanted to change it, and that's why they were so passionate about Howard Dean, and the internet gave them a vehicle for changing that, for demanding that kind of change from the political establishment that they really didn't have before. And on the Obama Senate campaign, it was a little different, but a similar kind of sentiment that there was the institutions that had kind of decided a lot of things didn't have quite the control they thought they did. That the world was a different place, and there was a new kind of force rising. You know, there's a guy, Jim Moore, wrote an essay called "The Second Global Superpower Rears Its Beautiful Head," which I always love for the poetry of it. Mm. And he argues that, you know, global public opinion in the age of the internet is a global superpower of sorts, and one that can't be ignored. And I think there is truth to a growing and power outside of our established institutions, and it's what happens when all of us carry around that power as individuals. And that's something I've been very much an observer and participant in, not necessarily a leader or innovator, because it's something bigger, way bigger than any individual. And I really have a sense of great urgency and conviction that we have to understand and take advantage of that, of this changing dynamic of power, and use it to build the kind of world we want to live in. Otherwise, if we don't drive it with some intention, we'll end up in some unusual and unexpected places.
The name of the book is The End of Big: How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Nick O'Melia, I thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Again, the title of the book, The End of Big, it's published by St. Martin's Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.